Welcome to Madame Podcast. Today's special guest is Dr. David P. Gushee, who is a distinguished university professor of Christian ethics at Mercer University. Today he joins us to share his book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. He also discusses patriotism, nationalism, authoritarianism, whiteness, and so much more. Please stay tuned. Are you navigating a challenging landscape of faith deconstruction, seeking a path that affirms your deepest intuitions and values? Then please join Dr. Thomas J. Ord and Dr. Tripp Fuller for a transformative online class called God After Deconstruction. The six-week journey is designed to embrace the uncertainty, explore profound topics, and offer a constructive, hope-filled vision of God grounded in open and relational theology. In this course, we aim to foster a thoughtful and inclusive space where participants can explore a variety of topics crucial to the journey of reconstructing their spiritual beliefs. This is presented by Homebird Christianity and Center for Open and Relational Theology. Please go to www.tripfuller.com to register today. A course like this is typically offered for $100, $125 or more, but you can contribute whatever you can to help make this possible for everyone. With deep roots in the Christian tradition and open to engaging dialogue, William B. Erman's publishing company is committed to the life of the Religious Academy, to the church, and to the role of religion and culture. With a history spanning over 100 years, Erman publishes the finest literature in theology, biblical studies, and religious history, and popular titles in spirituality, ministry, and cultural criticism. In addition to David Gushee, authors publishing with Erdman's include Padraig O. Tama, Amy Peeler, Matthew Bates, David Hummel, Janet Kellogg-Ray, and more. Popular themes throughout the 2024 book season include titles on evangelicalism and politics, faith deconstruction, and a supply of captivating literary nonfiction selections. Visit the all-new www.erdmans.com to order your books today. While you're there on the website, remember to sign up for our monthly newsletter called The Logo to stay in the know regarding upcoming releases, author events, and all things Erdmans. I'm going back to the Wild Goose Festival on July 11th to the 14th at Union Grove, North Carolina. Please join me at this wonderful event with fantastic preachers, speakers, musicians, and more. Please go to www.wildgoosefestival.org and register today.
This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Dreams are born, minds are changed, spirits rearranged. And people leave with eyes and arms open to the whole wide, aching world. Ready to go to work, to stand for justice, and sing new songs of hope. Ready to make a difference. This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Tears and laughter collide, converge, make something amazingly new together. Sometimes even mercy falls like rain. Questions are brought out of hiding, and somehow, some way, hope rises like bread. This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. And the Wild Goose Festival only happens because of you.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com. This is Madang, an outdoor living room for guests to share their experiences and their work. I invite you to come in and stay for a while.
Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is David P. Gashi. Gashi is a distinguished university professor of Christian ethics at Mercer University. He also serves as chair in Christian social ethics at Free University Amsterdam and a senior research fellow at International Baptist Theological Studies Center, both in Amsterdam. His many books include Righteous Gentiles of the Holocaust, Genocide and Moral Obligation. Today, he joins us on Madang Podcast to share his newest book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. The most persistent myth in U.S. is the notion that we are a Christian nation. Without denigrating the contributions of the Christian religion to the development of American society, Ruben Rosario Rodriguez writes, David Gashi critiques idolatrous forms of authoritarian reactionary Christianity that actively undermine democratic institutions, which in his analysis reflects a global trend toward populist, anti-democratic politics. So, David, welcome to Madang Podcast.
Grace, it's truly an honor to be on your podcast.
It's so wonderful to have you. You know, when I think about in the past, we've actually served on the AAR board of directors together.
Yes, it. I guess it was about 5 years ago now. It's hard to believe, but
yeah, back I was a nobody.
Yeah.
For the president.
no way. But it was back in that before time, you know, before COVID. But yes, I'm glad to be involved in your work in some other ways too, you know.
So. Yeah, because before we served on the board together, we never really interacted together. But since then, if you said it was about 5 years ago, you know, you were the president. I was just, I don't even know what I was on the board anymore, but I wasn't that important. So, and then since then, you wrote in that book, Christianity in North America.
Right?
You co-wrote a piece. Yeah, it was an excellent piece. You co-wrote it. That one was published with University of Edinburgh. And then you wrote a fabulous foreword for my forthcoming book, When God Became White.
Thank you for that invitation. Yeah, for both those invitations. It was pretty exciting to have a chance to do that Edinburgh piece, too. That was basically, I think it was white North American Christianity was the topic.
I think so, yeah.
Focused on evangelicalism and then your fabulous book. I was really glad to have a chance to engage it. And it's a really important book. And so, yeah, so we're getting a chance to finally work together. So it's really cool.
Oh, and hopefully a bit more in the future, too.
I hope so.
So, you know, I love everything that you do. So thank you. And I think you've written over 24 books, right?
The one coming out in the spring will be number 29.
You have 29?
Well, yes. Well, you have a bunch of them now too, right?
I know, but not 29. My goodness, I didn't know you because I was just searching you and it said 24, but I guess I missed the other 5 books. Wow, yeah. That is amazing. And you're a grandfather?
I am. My happiest days are spent with our grandkids. We have 3 grandkids who are 9, 5, and just under 1 year old. So yes.
Wow. A 9-year old?
Yes.
Wow, you became, because you're so young. I don't think you're much older than me, but you became a grandfather so early then.
Our oldest married pretty early, and then they had Jonah before too long. So yeah. You know, the younger you are, the more energy you have to deal with kids. So that was a gift, actually. Whether we'll have more grandkids, I don't know, but such a blessing. Yeah,
that's so great. I know my kids probably won't listen to Madang. Well, once in a while they do, but if they are, you know, that's always my wish that one of them will come in and get married and have some kids.
Well, I hope that dream comes true for you.
Sure. Because by the time, you know, when I think about when my mother was the same age as me, I think she already had like 2 or 3 grandkids but then she had, you know, she got married young and, you know, but anyway, times are different, but congratulations on your 3 grandkids. That's
Thank
amazing.
You. Thank you.
So today we are here to discuss this amazing book, Defending Democracy from Its
Christian Enemies. Fabulous. Did you come up with the title or did the publisher?
I did. It just came to me. The origin of the book was my inaugural address at the Free University of Amsterdam May of 22. And I just knew that that was what the title needed to be. And as I developed it, it never really changed. It's a pretty provocative title. But I think it's a descriptive one. So yeah, I didn't feel the need for a subtitle. It says what it needs to say, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a great title because I would be scared to write from Christian Enemies. But anyway, I'm glad you did. At least someone has to do it. So I'm glad you did that. So it's a great title and it's a great book. And for me, I wasn't that knowledgeable about this topic, but I learned so much from it. And you wrote it, you know, it's so easy to read your writing. It's just, you know, it's not so heady, but, you know, lots of good information. And at the beginning, you wrote 4 important things that we need to know. Christians should support democracy. Many Christians instead favor authoritarian and reactionary political trends. Christians turn out to be among the leading threats to democracy, and Christians need to remit to democracy. So like, that's pretty heavy. I don't know if you want to expand on it because the first one I agreed, that's pretty good. Christians should support democracy, but I never thought that, you know, Christians instead favor authoritarian and reactionary politics. But after reading it, you are so true. Like, it's so true because that's been, you know, then I look back at what has been happening. So I don't know if you wanted to expand on those 4 important things that you just lay out right at the beginning on page 1.
I was trained as a preacher, Grace. And so I remember a preaching professor who said, tell them what you're going to tell them. And so, and then tell them what you told them. So, first, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them, and then at the end, tell them what you just told them. So, anyway, sometimes I do.
I have to remember that.
Yeah, it helps people to remember it. I do try to write for people to understand. I don't understand academics who write in a way that only other academics can understand. Yeah. I think that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. The book, at one level, is a case for democracy, for democratic government, for however frustrating and flawed it is, it's the best available political system. And it's a time where that argument needs to be renewed because there's a drifting away from democracy on the part of many Christians. And that's the second point. I come up with the phrase authoritarian, reactionary Christian politics. That's the main, you might say, diagnostic phrase that's new in the book. And I show with historical study and comparative studies, Christians making this turn, being suspicious of democracy, preferring top-down authoritarian government, and tending to be reactionary towards social changes that they don't like. So I know we'll talk about that later, probably. And so then Christian populations, self-identified Christians, church-going folks often, become a possible threat to democracy in many different countries, which is shocking because we always want to have Christians be on the good team, but sometimes they're not. And that now is a time to remember why Christians from the early modern period gradually made their way to the support of democracy and need to do so again right now.
Yeah. Well, when you wrote that second point, all I can think about was Trump. Yeah. I don't know if is that what was happening with Christians who really follow Trump, and you know, we're going to go into the next election cycle. Is that what's happening, where Christians instead favor authoritarian and reactionary political trends?
He was what was in my mind as I was writing the book. You know, one way to say it, I think readers often or hearers often like to know, well, what is it that motivated you to do a book?
Yeah.
What motivated me to do this book was shock at everything that happened during the Trump presidency, shock and dismay. And then January 6th was a big culmination of that. And the way that Christians, the self-identified Christians, were some of his strongest supporters and still are. Evangelicals, which is the community that I come from, but not only evangelicals. So I started off by saying, okay, how could this have happened? A lot of people were asking that question. And I thought, and the main term that has been used since 2019, 2020 is, oh, it's the problem is Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. And I concluded, while that was helpful, and some of the studies that have been done there are helpful, that I thought it was possible to sharpen the description. And so reactionary means these are people who react with visceral negativity to most of the social changes that have happened in our country since the 60s. And authoritarian means both that they have a vision of kind of centralized authority determining what people should believe and do, and a growing impatience with democracy when democracy does not deliver the results that they want. And Trump embodies both. He's not any kind of Christian, but he exudes that reactionary resentment, right? And he also exudes authoritarianism. It will be how I say it is. Nobody can tell me what I can and can't do. And so he found democratic constraints, like a Supreme Court that didn't always let him do what he wanted, or Congress that didn't always support his ideas, or an opposition party, or the media. Classic authoritarians want nobody to get in their way as they pursue their goals. But anyway, the book ends up showing that it isn't only Trump. And authoritarianism is a form of government. And you see it both in countries that say that they're Christian and in countries that don't say they're Christian. And you see it in countries that say they're democracies and in countries that don't say they're democracies. Centralized authority. Nobody to tell the big guy what he's not allowed to do. Trump lives in that world in his head, and he wants a government that works that way too, and a country that works that way.
So, well, I don't want to talk about Trump too much, but right. One more question before we leave Trump is, as you just said that he's not really a Christian. So why do Christians think that he is a Christian?
Yeah, they need to believe that because they're supporting him. It'd be like, let's say you were raised in a conservative Christian family, and I know you were, and your parents said you have to date a Christian. Uh-huh. But the person you fall for is, you know, something else. Uh-huh. But you tell yourself and them that you've actually found a Christian because it's really, really important to you that they allow you to date that person, right? I think that Christians fell for Trump. A lot of these evangelicals fell for Trump because they liked the reactionary spirit and they liked the patriarchalism and the veiled or not so veiled racism and xenophobia and stuff. And they actually liked the authoritarianism. And so they either had to say, well, he's not a Christian, but he gives us what we want and believe in, so that's fine. Or he actually is a Christian. The most hilarious is he's a baby Christian, or he just converted, or he's always just on the brink of converting or something, or still working on his baby Christianity. The things that people tell themselves to be able to feel good about themselves, it's hilarious sometimes, if it weren't so sad, you know?
Yeah, I shouldn't be laughing about it because it is very dangerous, and he may be, you know, elected again. And so I don't understand why people can't just open up their eyes and see what he is and what he stands for. So thank you. That is really helpful for me to understand what has been happening and what continues to happen. You also mentioned Christian nationalism and you wanted to hone in. I thought your book was so helpful because you laid out the difference, patriotism, nationalism, and then ultra-nationalism. So for our listeners, what are these three terms? Because they're really important to understand democracy too.
Yeah. In Christian ethics, which is my field, there's been a long tradition of thinking about how Christians should relate to the countries that they live in, right? Mm-hmm. Patriotism simply means love of the homeland, right? Love of the fatherland or the motherland. And in general, Christian ethics, in its 150-year-old tradition, modern incarnation, has been willing to offer a qualified acceptance of patriotism. It's natural for people to love their country and to love their homeland and their people. It's kind of like loving your parents or feeling a sense of connection to your siblings or something. It's natural. The problem is if it gets hyped up to become something like nationalism, which is maybe an excessive patriotism, a idolatrous patriotism, a patriotism that is unwilling to ever think critically about what the country is doing. I remember during the Vietnam era, people shouted at the protesters, "My country, right or wrong."
Wow.
Yeah, so how dare you challenge our country? I'm going to support it, whatever it does. See, that's uncritical patriotism. So you might say that nationalism is hyped up uncritical patriotism. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, ultranationalism would be go up higher on the scale, right? Even more hyped up, even more uncritical, and even more denigrating of other peoples, other nationalities, other countries. Maybe an imperialistic posture. We are allowed to do whatever we want to these other people. They are lesser. They may even be seen as like a somewhat of a lesser breed or a lesser tribe or species or whatever. So ultranationalism tends to get connected to conquest and violence and genocide and the dismissal of the rights and dignity and needs of other people. So I think that my problem with the use of the word Christian nationalism in the current conversation is that I don't really think it's that they're talking about. It's not nationalism like hyped up patriotism that is the problem here. It's a reactionary disdain for every social change that has happened in the country, like civil rights movement and immigration and multiculturalism and the women's movement and sexual liberation and so on, gay rights movement. And a desire for a strong man to stamp it all out and restore order again. I don't really think that's nationalism. I think it's something different. But there is one way to draw the connection is if authoritarian reactionary folks were to succeed, the achievement would amount to the forcible creation of a conservative, patriarchal Christian nation. So with a suppression of the rights and liberties of pretty much everybody else. And in that sense, you might say that Christian nation of that type is the goal. Mm-hmm. Reactionary spirit is the jet fuel that gets people there. And authoritarianism is the strategy. If we can't use democracy, we will manipulate or destroy democracy to achieve our goal. That's how I would put all those words together.
Yeah, that's so helpful, because you mentioned earlier, you know, you coined the term authoritarian reactionary Christianity, and, you know, used ARC, which is very helpful because it is a long term. You know, I always think I want to coin a word or coin a term, and I've never done that, but this is quite helpful. So you want authoritarian reactionary Christianity to kind of replace the notion of Christian nationalism. Is it more accurate?
I would just like it to be in the conversation. And I actually ran it by some of the folks who like Andrew Whitehead, who did, you know, some of the really important work on Christian nationalism, Sam Perry, too, and Phil Gorski, some of the three sociologists who were important on this. And, you know, in different ways, they said, yeah, I see that. And also, authoritarian reactionary Christianity may have a more of an international and historical scope. It's not just about the U.S. Okay. So if you're wanting to do cross-cultural, cross-national comparisons, it may be a term that has broader broader implications. Wow. And by the way, one could also, and I do a little bit of this in the book, just mention it, there could be authoritarian reactionary Buddhism, authoritarian reactionary Muslim politics. There could be authoritarian reactionary Jewish politics, Hindu politics. And like, I think examples of that would be like the Modi government in India, the Erdogan government in Turkey, and the right-wing government that has been leading Israel. In some ways, they could be fairly described as representing authoritarian, reactionary, religiously tinged visions from different traditions. So it's not just a Christian problem.
Yeah, so actually that I love that term, because you're making it global and your book is global. I thought you were going to just focus on American politics and American democracy, but you did actually go global and you brought in Zionism. And so you just kind of mentioned it right now because of the global context right now. Did you want to say a little bit about what Zionism is and how you see it being played out in the war? And yeah,
I have a chapter in the book that uses Israel as a case study. It was before the current situation, right? But basically, here's what I would say. The modern state of Israel was born in 1948 by UN authorization. And it represented the fulfillment of the dreams of Jewish people in dispersion over many centuries. Not everybody had the dream, but many did. And for many, many decades, Jewish people had been settling in the former homeland, Palestine. And the founding government of the modern state of Israel was interestingly secular and socialist and Zionist, but not religious Zionist. Mm-hmm. Zionism here basically meant a homeland for the Jewish people on at least part of its historic territory. And the chapter talks about how this secular, socialist, Zionist vision had certain strengths to it. For one thing, it was not fired by a kind of a religious zeal like you see among some of the ultra religious zealots that helped to make up the current Israeli government or the settler population, right? So they didn't have in the beginning maximalist visions of reclaiming the whole land between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, because that's what God gave Israel in, you know, 1000 BC or something, right? They were more pragmatic. And but what they were committed to was a Jewish state somewhere in the territory between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. And they agreed to share that land with the Palestinians. Unfortunately, an agreement was never able to be permanently worked out between the populations. And there's been war after war after war since 1948. In each successive war, essentially, Israel has gotten more territory and the Palestinians have lost more territory. And now with the kind of the ultra, especially the religious Zionists, mainly acting in the West Bank, there's an increasing contempt for Palestinian life. And I think, sadly, with you had the horrific attack on Israel on October 7th, and then a ferocious mass response that has by now taken, I think it's almost 20,000 lives in Gaza and leveled that pretty much that entire territory. You know, my dissertation was on the Holocaust, and I spent a lot of years studying the long, difficult Jewish sojourn in history. And one of the bodies of literature that almost nobody has read, but that I had a chance to read, was what you might say the prophetic Jewish figures were saying in 1948. People like Martin Buber. They were basically saying, okay, we now have the land. We now have power over a territory for the first time since the Maccabees. Will we remember the lessons of our own suffering and the mistreatment that was visited upon us? Or will we, operating out of trauma and anger and fear, become an oppressive power? And I wrote about Martin Buber calling for a Jewish humanism in 1948. People like Abraham Joshua Heschel and Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel tended to be a little more uncritical of Israel, but basically saying we have values, these values that we see in the prophets. We must be constrained by these values. Let's just say that I've never sensed that constrained Jewish prophetic vision or the Jewish humanist vision, I've never seen that in Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. And in some of the people around him, in the last government, you had people who were maximalist, nationalists, pretty denigrating of the value of the Palestinian human population, right? So there's no future in that. That's a future only of war and more war. So I am brokenhearted over the whole situation. Yeah. That's what I would say about it. Yeah.
It's devastating. And then when you throw in Christian Zionists in the mix of that, it's just
yes. Yeah. Because there was a version of Christian Zionism that just basically said, okay, we support that the Jewish people need to have a country between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. But then the majority, it seems like the more powerful version of that in the U.S. setting especially, has been another maximalist vision. It's a kind of a, well, God promised Abraham all of this territory, and that means the Jewish people, and that means from the Nile to the cedars of Lebanon. And so in essence, no, a religious, how about if we say a religious dreamscape superimposed on real human populations, no matter what the consequences are for those populations. So yes, U.S. Christian Zionism has been a really destructive part of this story. And, you know, by the way, some of these are the same people who are supporting authoritarian reactionary Christianity in the U.S. For religious reasons.
Yeah, so it is devastating what's happening. And, you know, I had Dr. Mitri Rahab, a Palestinian Christian, on Madame. So it was very helpful to hear from him, you know, what is happening on the ground against the Palestinians. So thank you for sharing with us, you know, these different terms that are just thrown around and people aren't sure, you know, what Zionism is and nationalism. So I think your book is so helpful. And then hearing from you is also very, very helpful. So, you know, once again, I want to thank you for writing the foreword to my book. I first called it Whiteness, and then InterVarsity changed it to When God Became White. But I wish I had read your book before I finished my book, because you do have so much in there that would have helped me unpack it a bit further. And you quote Robert Jones, P. Jones, who I also had on Madan. And I found that discussion really, really helpful. And you talking about, you know, white Christians who chose white tyranny over democracy when it supported slavery for 250 years. So I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that. I thought it was so helpful.
In the latter part of the book, after analyzing the problem of authoritarian reactionary Christianity, I ask, do we have any resources in the Christian, you might say, in the toolbox that can help us be pro-democratic? And one of them is, I call the dissenting Black democratic tradition in the U.S. It's African Americans for the entirety of American history, colonial and ever since, saying, hey, by the way, your lovely democratic ideals are being violated every day in how you have structured the society and in how we are being treated. If you really want to be a democracy, you're going to have to include us on equal terms. And then, of course, that would apply to every other non-white group in the U.S. in different ways. And so in the chapter on the Black democratic tradition in the U.S., I talk about the accusation that whiteness subverted democracy in the U.S. from before the very beginning. The idea that this is a land that belongs to white people of European descent, that the way we're going to look at the world is in a hierarchy with us at the top and everybody arrayed below us. And as your book so beautifully indicates, and the way we're going to look at God is as a white guy, basically, mm-hmm. ratifying and blessing our conquest and domination. And a white male God ratifying patriarchy. So one way to look at what's happening in the U.S. right now is a struggle between a tribalist white quasi-democracy vision. You might, to be provocative, you might call it a Confederate States of America vision, or a slaveholder vision from 1810, versus a perfected democracy or an improved democracy in which at last the promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and all people are created equal is actually put into place. And one way to analyze the problem is with every advance in our society towards a society that isn't just dominated by white guys. A society where you have people, you know, you have women and you have people of different sexual orientations and gender identities and people from different racial ethnic backgrounds and a multiracial post white dominated society in which everybody is committed to everybody having a place at the table on equal terms. That's my political vision. That's what I mean by democracy. I picture a big round table with everybody gets one chair. Nobody gets more than one chair. And everybody's voice counts the same. And I think there's a significant chunk of the Christian, quote unquote, population in the U.S. that is not their vision. Their vision is, no, this country really belongs to white people, and it belongs to Christian people, and it belongs to native-born people, and it belongs, well, to people like us, you know, to my ancestors. Yeah. And so part of the jet fuel of reaction is, how dare anybody think that this country should be one where whiteness is dethroned and we're all here on equal terms.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that vision that you have. That's why I love white people like you and Robert Jones who keep fighting this whiteness. And I believe you did your PhD at Union.
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So studied with James Cone.
You studied with James Cone?
Yeah, he wasn't my main advisor, but I did have a class with him and got to know him. And I say in the book that his critique of white Christianity struck me as radical when I was in school. It doesn't strike me as radical anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you for that. And you do quote him and you said, Cone says, whiteness rather than democracy is what rules America. Whiteness is not only anti-Black, it is anti-human, and it is anti-democratic. So I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about that. I think he's dead right on about what is actually happening here in the U.S. And when you see what has happened with Trump and what continues to happen, I think he's right that whiteness rather than democracy is what rules America.
Now, some people would say that money is what rules America, and that
they go together.
They do go together. Some people, I've had one reviewer who said the analysis on the economic side needed more development in the book, you know, because it's not only about race and it's not only about authoritarianism, it's also about capitalism and who gets to control the money. But, you know, I think a clue here that helped the scales fall from my eyes was the vicious white Christian, quote unquote, reaction to Barack Obama. I think the election of Barack Obama twice to be president utterly freaked out a chunk of the U.S. population. A sense of an alien other in the White House. A sense that the democracy was producing inconceivable results. And then when 2016 election cycle came around, and I mean, there was a little bit of contingency and chance here, but there were 17 people running for the Republican nomination in 2016. 17. And the party, in the end, picked the most reactionary, the most anti-Obama, the one with the worst track record on race, I think, of all of the 17 options. So in other words, they picked the anti-Obama. Mm-hmm. Also a person with an awful record of personal moral integrity and business integrity. And so to me, Trump represents a kind of a, it's like a raised middle finger to a country that would elect Barack Obama president twice. It's like, oh, is that what you're going to do? Okay, well, F you, and we're going to be the exact opposite. And sorry to be crude, I never speak this way on podcasts, but I really think that about describes it. And so I was also struck by the people who in 2015, 2016, the Black people especially, who said, we knew it was going to be Trump, and we knew he was going to win. So it's like, the issue is, how could you all have been surprised? We weren't surprised because we understand this country better than you do. And so there are a lot of us that a lot of illusions were shattered, that maybe some less privileged people didn't have to have illusions shattered because they didn't have the illusions in the first place. I do want to say about my friend Robbie Jones from Mississippi. His another Southern Baptist background person, just like me, his recent work is some of the most honest excavation of white racism that has been produced in the last, you know, 50 years. And he's exploring his own roots. And there's a repentance in that work that I want to honor. And I hope that my work kind of has some of that too. Like, what has happened? what has happened with the white Christian population in the U.S., it's not everybody, but it's a lot, it's the majority, is shameful. And it's so distressing, and it needs to be named, it needs to be analyzed, but it also needs to be repudiated and repented. And my work, hopefully, is helping to contribute to that. So at least I hope so.
Yeah, it is. And this conversation is so rich. I'm just enjoying it so much. I'm thinking I may have to have you and Robert Jones in a discussion together, because you guys have such similar backgrounds and you're kind of covering similar topics at this moment. So I find it very, very helpful. You also quote Cohn and says, white supremacy is older than democracy. So that was a shock to me that, wow, I didn't realize that this is happening. And it helped kind of explain so many things that has happened here in the U.S. soil. So can you just elaborate a little bit on what Cohn is talking about? And you also quote Eddie Glaude too, who I really, really love. And I know he has a book coming out, so he'll be on Madame too. Mm-hmm. So, the three of you kind of doing this and Cohn in the mix is just a helpful discussion for so many of us who are trying to make sense of what is happening here in the U.S. and across the world.
I had the privilege of getting to know Eddie in the presidential succession group at AAR when we were all in there together, and so much respect for him. White supremacy is older than democracy. It's just a fact. I mean, white supremacy, the idea that white people are supreme, the supreme race. And then it got conflated with Christianity. Whiteness equals Christianity, equals superiority. Equals the right to rule, the right to dominate, the right to conquer, the right to enslave, the right to bulldoze existing populations. It's such a hubristic kind of prideful vision. It's also a deeply ingrained habit. And Robbie traces it back to the doctrine of discovery. Others are tracing it back even further. Certainly it goes back to the origins of colonialism. The great wide world that we are setting out in our ships to conquer, it belongs to us. And others are allowed to live if we choose that. And if they knuckle under to our definition of reality and our power. We're free to enslave an entire race of people and to justify that from within the terms of Christian faith. And the democracy that we built 1776 and 1789, with both Enlightenment and Christian influences, was compromised by the white supremacist vision that got there before. So we're going to have democracy, but also slavery. And we're going to count slaves as 3/5 of a person. The most symbolic, telling negation of all people are created equal. So, the fact that there are large chunks of the country that do not want this story told or even discussed in school. It's like, I'm not listening. No, this is not like crazy talk. This is documentable history.
Yeah.
And it's not just Republicans either. I remember running into the quote from Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. When Roosevelt was talking to two of his cabinet members, one was Jewish and one was Catholic. And he said to them, reportedly, "This is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. Everyone else is here by sufferance." Which means our country. Wow. Maybe you Jewish guy are allowed to be here. Maybe you Catholic guy are allowed to be here. But just remember who's in charge. And to the extent that that ideology is the one that has been challenged over and over and over again since 1789, and never more intensively maybe than during the Civil Rights Movement, and that ideology always bounces back with backlash, always. And I think we're in that kind of moment now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all that discussion. You know, for me, I just go back to, you know, when Christianity just made God white, a white male, you know, that's where the crux of this, or the, you know, the problem of this whiteness is. And as I said before, I wish I had your book before I finished. And, you know, I'm always so embarrassed when I send off that draft manuscript to all the endorsers and then for you, because it's like this unedited manuscript. So I'm so embarrassed that you read that one and wrote the foreword. But anyway, in your book, you define whiteness in such a good way. You write, "Whiteness is a name for this evil power that damages everything that it touches, not just its non-white targets, but also the souls of white people and the moral integrity of whiteness damaged Christianity." I was like, wow, I wish I kind of quoted you, because, you know, I was like struggling trying to write that book. But this one, your definition is like so powerful to me, because it is exactly what it is, and people will not accept it. So tell the listeners more this damage that whiteness does to everything that it touches.
I'll try some Christian talk here to help.
Okay,
do that.
Yeah, do some Christian talk. I'm ready for your Christian. You can preach too.
Okay, I can do that. Well, any approach in which I and my group are intrinsically superior to somebody else in their group, sets the other up for domination and mistreatment, and sets my group up for an undue pride and sense of superiority. And that's not good for the human spirit, right? Also, because there's something in us that sees the fundamental worth and equality that, you know, in other words, if I see I'll do a grandchild image. If I see six little kids under the age of two play, you know, kind of crawling around on the playground, right? And they're of all different races and colors. Almost every decent human being looking at those six little kids crawling around of different colors and whatever knows that each one of those lives is equally valuable. That it would be obscene to look at one of or two of those kids and say, nah, not worth anything, right? So there's something in our gut that knows this. But if we have created a social system of my group is superior and their group is inferior, then we have to tell ourselves lies daily to be able to sustain the untruthfulness that we have built into our way of looking at the world, right? Nobody wrote about this any better than James Baldwin, one of my favorite writers. Baldwin talked about the enormous psychological and intellectual effort that white people had to undertake on a daily basis to believe all the lies that they told themselves about themselves and about other people, right? Uh-huh. And then the sustaining a sense of innocence was the hardest of all. I think there's one quote from Baldwin where he says, it's not just the injustice, it's the innocence that is the most obnoxious. To victimize whole populations and to remain blissfully ignorant of what you're doing and feeling innocent about it is quite an achievement. So, you know, my presidential address for AAR was a study of novels by African-American writers. And I just listened for what these classic and contemporary novels said about white people, what the characters were saying, what they were observing. And that was quite an experience, kind of a risky presidential address approach, but it was well received. But what they said repeatedly is, white people living in so many lies and so much self-deceit and so much damage that they do to themselves and other people. It's an exhausting thing to even have to witness, let alone to be. So it hurt, you know, Martin Luther King said, racism hurts the oppressed for sure, but it also hurts the oppressor. Yeah. It distorts their sense of self-worth and the reasons why one would feel worthy. Damages human relations, creates alienation, so creates distance in relationship with God, if God is rightly understood. So it damages everything that it touches.
Yeah.
And it damages democracy too, right?
Yeah. That is so helpful. I just, you know, I love the book, Defending Democracy from its Christian Ethics. I mean, from its Christian Enemies, sorry. And, you know, it's such a helpful book. And then at the end, you have these great discussion questions. So before we end, there was one that caught my attention. It says, church community is more authoritarian or more democratic in its practices. I thought that was such a great question. Church community is more authoritarian or more democratic in its practices. What do you think? I thought that was such a great question, because I think in some ways it is way more authoritarian than democratic. I don't know what you had in mind when you wrote that question.
You know, again, I'm thinking about some of your work that I've read, where you talked about the authoritarianism of your religious community and its background, right? You know, authoritarian. Yeah. This is the truth. Uh-huh. We are going to tell you what it is. We are going to enforce it. Your protests are not going to have any impact. We rule in the name of God. And what I'm saying is, working on this book reminded me that probably more Christians around the world live in that kind of religious subculture than live in a subculture that's more like, together, we equal and equally significant members of the community of faith wrestle with the meaning of our faith and what it means to follow Jesus. So we read scripture together and argue together about what it might mean as equals. And different people have a voice, and their voice matters. So again, it's that round table. I've spent a lot of my adult life teaching Sunday school classes that are where I've tried to create that kind of environment. So picture 16 people around a big old table, and the Bible is open, and together we're talking about what it might mean. I'm not declaring what it means. We are exploring what it means together, and everybody's voice is going to matter. But I think to that discussion question, I think only a minority of Christian people actually experience that as their form of Christian community. It wasn't what you experienced growing up, right?
It wasn't, yeah.
this is how it will be. And it was usually the male pastor, right?
Yeah.
This is how it's gonna be, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I was so struck in your writing by, I mean, what impact this has on women, for example. Yeah. Constantly suppressed, your voice doesn't count. You don't get an interpretive voice. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, by the way, I want to celebrate the achievement of you finding your own interpretive voice and saying, yeah, here it is. And you're not going to stop me from articulating the way I'm going to read the faith and read the Bible and think about God. That's liberation. But I know it's been a hard fought challenge for you and for so many, right? You know, when you're a male in patriarchal religious systems, it is assumed that your voice matters. When you're a female, it is assumed that your voice is to be subordinated. And that's just only one dimension of the authoritarianism. I also talk about clerical authoritarianism. The clergy, they're the ones who say what truth is going to be, right? So I do, in the book, I argue for, if you are in a part of the religious community that is more democratic and egalitarian, celebrate that. And think of it as a resource for supporting democracy, because democracy depends on a vision of power that is more egalitarian. When we go to the polls on November 5th, everybody who is allowed to vote, every citizen, everybody who has the franchise, has one vote. And nobody's vote counts more than anybody else's. That's so egalitarian. It took a long time to get there.
Yeah.
And part of what the book is about is Christianity was dragged kicking and screaming into the democratic age because it was more used to top-down authoritarianism. And but we learn to embrace democracy, and we need to learn to re-embrace democracy and not be seduced by authoritarians like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil or Donald J. friggin' Trump in the U.S.
Is my
anger oozing? I'm sorry, it's oozing a little bit today, but we are on the brink. I don't know when this is going to come out, but we are on the brink of the 2024 election year, and it's going to be a really hard year, and we all need to be ready for it. It's going to be a really hard year, I think.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Gashi. It's such a pleasure. You know, it was such a joy to work with you at AAR. And, you know, we were at Wild Goose together, and, you know, for you to write that contribution to Christianity in North America. And then such a big honor for me to have you write the foreword of When God Became White. Thank you. We need voices like you to be in solidarity with people of color and also to stand up for women of color too. So I just really appreciate the work that you do in the academy and in the church and for this fabulous book. So I hope everyone goes and reads this book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. It's such an insightful book, so easy to read. And with the discussion questions, I think church groups, faith communities can just read it together, or even families can read it together, because we know that families are always arguing, especially during the election cycle year. So I think families, you know, they say families who pray together will stay together. Maybe families who read this book together may stay together. So Dr. Gashi, thank you so much for being on this Badang podcast. It's such a joy to read your book and to hear from you. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation, my dear friend. And I've loved this conversation, and I look forward to the next thing we'll get to do together.
Yeah, we have to do lots together. You know, we have to stick together, you and Robbie and other people who do this type of work. It's so important because, you know, believe it or not, when we talk about it, not many people listen. That's the hard truth. But when white folks talk about it, you have a bigger audience. So I'm just grateful for your work and being in solidarity with us, people of color, and with women of color. Thank you so much for your work.
You're very welcome. All of us are needed. I think we have a majority when we all work together. We can't be divided. And so in this upcoming year and in the years to come, let's keep working together.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on Madame Podcast.
Sure.
Are you navigating a challenging landscape of faith deconstruction, seeking a path that affirms your deepest intuitions and values? Then please join Dr. Thomas J. Ord and Dr. Tripp Fuller for a transformative online class called God After Deconstruction. The six-week journey is designed to embrace the uncertainty, explore profound topics, and offer a constructive, hope-filled vision of God grounded in open and relational theology. In this course, we aim to foster a thoughtful and inclusive space where participants can explore a variety of topics crucial to the journey of reconstructing their spiritual beliefs. This is presented by Homebird Christianity and Center for Open and Relational Theology. Please go to www.tripfuller.com to register today. A course like this is typically offered for $100, $125 or more, but you can contribute whatever you can to help make this possible for everyone. With deep roots in the Christian tradition and open to engaging dialogue, William B. Erman's Publishing Company is committed to the life of the Religious Academy, to the church, and to the role of religion and culture. With a history spanning over 100 years, Erman publishes the finest literature in theology, biblical studies, and religious history, and popular titles in spirituality, ministry, and cultural criticism. In addition to David Gashi, authors publishing with Erman's include Padraig O'Tama, Amy Peeler, Matthew Bates, David Hummel, Janet Kellogg-Ray, and more. Popular themes throughout the 2024 book season include titles on evangelicalism and politics, faith deconstruction, and a supply of captivating literary nonfiction selections. Visit the all-new www.erdmans.com to order your books today. While you're there on the website, remember to sign up for our monthly newsletter called The Logo to stay in the know regarding upcoming releases, author events, and all things Erdmans. I'm going back to the Wild Goose Festival on July 11th to the 14th at Union Grove, North Carolina. Please join me at this wonderful event with fantastic preachers, speakers, musicians, and more. Please go to www.wildgoosefestival.org and register today.
This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Dreams are born, minds are changed, spirits rearranged, and people. People leave with eyes and arms open to the whole wide, aching world. Ready to go to work, to stand for justice, and sing new songs of hope. Ready to make a difference. This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. Tears and laughter collide, converge, make something amazingly new together. Sometimes even mercy falls like rain. Questions are brought out of hiding, and somehow, some way, hope rises like bread. This is what happens because the Wild Goose Festival happens. And the Wild Goose Festival only happens because of you.
Who is God when we see God through the eyes of survivors? Many books have dealt with sexual abuse scandals in the church and the role of pastoral care for survivors. Others have provided liberative readings of biblical texts to support survivors of sexual violence. Surviving God takes a new approach, centering the voices of sexual abuse survivors while rethinking key Christian beliefs, starting from experiences of oppression, beliefs that contribute to oppression are challenged, and new, hopeful, and healing beliefs take their place. Please pre-order Surviving God, co-written by Dr. Susie Shaw and Grace Jisun Kim.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com.